So good evening, everyone. How wonderful to see you. Thank you for turning on your videos for those who can, so I can kind of see all your shining faces, all bodhisattvas in the boxes. Well, I think almost everyone here was also here last week. Maybe one or two people knew. But we started, or I started a series of talks on a very famous teaching poem in the Zen tradition called the Jewel Song of the Jewel Mirrored Samadhi. And it's too long for us to recite each time. We did recite it last time, so we're not going to recite it again today, but if you don't have the poem, it is also on their website.
On the events listing for this.
Sorry, suddenly flipped. Yeah, so you can find this this poem on the events. And again, it's the Song of the Jeweled Mirror Samadhi. So last week I gave a little bit of background and talked about the great Chinese Chan or Zen teacher, Dongshan, who is believed, or at least considered by Zen practitioners, to be the author of this poem. Although that is highly disputed by scholars. Scholars like to do this kind of thing, argue back and forth about whether a person actually wrote this poem or it was composed later. But for us, of course, it doesn't matter if Dongshan is the author or not. But what can be helpful, I think, for us are the stories of his life and of his practice. And I think what can be helpful for us is what this poem, this Song of the Jeweled Mirror Samadhi, may show us about our own life, our own understanding of what it means to be alive and human in this world today. How are we connected to this world? So last week, as I said, we read the poem together. And I would like to suggest that you read the poem to yourself this week, at least once, maybe several times. And please take a note or two of what stands out for you as you read this poem. What seems opaque? What seems beautiful? Regardless of whether you understand the meaning of it or not, or think you understand it or not. And then please keep reading it. I'll read it over the next 3 weeks as we talk about this poem and see if your response to this poem that is so old, you know, written in the 800s or so, in a language so distant from English, this classical Chinese language, see if your response to this poem changes over the weeks. So in addition to the talking a little bit about Dongshan last week, we also considered the title and the first couplet, which introduces us to the word thusness. It's not unusual, I should say, for, you know, the traditional Zen teachers to spend, you know, several days just talking about the title of something before they even get into the text. So I was rather brief by some standards. So thusness, rather odd word, or sometimes it's also translated as suchness. And this really lies at the heart of this poem. And notice at the very beginning of the poem, Dongshan writes, "You have it. You have suchness. You have a thusness." And as we talked a little bit about last week, this thusness or suchness that Dongshan is telling us is the flowing, all-inclusive nature of who you are. And although in our daily life, We often get lost in confusion, distraction. We are never apart from this suchness, this thusness. And I suggested also another perhaps similar way to approach this, at least as it's done in the Zen tradition, using words like Buddha nature, Buddha Dharma, that completeness of who you are beyond the story, beyond the narrative about what we tell ourselves. So, let's continue on then with the poem. Filling a silver bowl with snow, hiding a heron in the moonlight. Taking a similar, they are not the same. When you mix them, you know where they are. We'll find in this poem, just as we see in this couplet here, Dzogchen describes this idea of thusness, this, I shouldn't actually call it an idea, but his sense of thusness, using imagery rather than logic or explanation or reasoning. And that is the Chinese way. Reasoning, logic was never emphasized. Instead, imagery and poetry were used to really touch the heart rather than engage the mind. So a silver bowl filled with snow, or a white heron perhaps flying against the full moon. Two images that show us things that are hard to distinguish perhaps at first glance. The silver bowl and the glistening snow, the heron as it flies in front of perhaps a bright moon, they're hard to discern. All of them being bright, white, and yet, of course, they are different. The silver bowl, snow, heron, and moon, each, of course, is unique. Yet, they share the bright whiteness. These images Dzogchen uses to help illustrate his theme of the particular within the universal. With these words, Dzogchen demonstrates for us the seemingly strange dichotomy of what we may call the relative and the absolute that lie all embraced within thusness or suchness, the great wholeness of things, of all things, of the great unity. For example, we might say compassion, an absolute, a universal. Wisdom and love also perhaps absolutes and universal in their way. But each must be expressed in a particular act. Right? What is love if it's not expressed? What is compassion if it's not expressed in this world? I think of the Bodhisattva of compassion, of boundless compassion, Avalokiteshvara, or in Japanese, Kannon, often described as assuming countless forms to share the Dharma and relieve the suffering of others according to each person's need. And in Kyoto, for those of you who have been there, at the famous temple, Sanju Sangendo, there is a beautiful old statue of Senju Kannon, the thousand-armed Kannon, the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara, right? You've probably seen pictures if you haven't actually been there. Arms, nothing but arms, right? And in each hand is an implement, or each hand makes a gesture, ready to respond to any need that is required. Let's go on to the next two lines here. The meaning is not in the words, yet it responds to the inquiring impulse. Move and you are trapped, miss and you fall into doubt and vacillation. Of course, the very fullness of reality itself, the very fullness of this cosmos is beyond our ability to adequately express in words. Yet thusness really begins to become apparent to us when we deeply probe our life. In Zazen, our everyday activities and the great vast world no longer seem so distinct as we drop our narrative about who and what we are. And taking the place of those relentless stories that go on through in our mind throughout the day, our busy day, taking that place is a perhaps a gentle, open awareness, free of judgment, with a kind of gentle probing. What is this? This moment, this breath. Move and you are trapped, Dongshan says. Isn't that true? Right? Striving to fix ourselves, aiming at a better or improved self, is really just a self-made trap. Zoketsu Norman Fishers, the founding teacher of Mountain Rain, and Zoketsu Norman Fishers' favorite traditional koan, or Zen story, expresses this, I think, really well. And this is a dialogue between two very famous Chinese ancestors, Zhao Zhou, when he was still a student, and his teacher Nanchuan. Let me read you the little dialogue here. Zhao Zhou earnestly asks Nanchuan, "What is the way?" Nanchuan said, "Everyday mind is the way." Zhao Zhou said, "Should I direct myself toward it or not?" Nanchuan replied, "If you try to turn toward it, you go against it." Zhao Zhou said, "If I do not turn toward it, how can I know what is the way?" And Nanchuan replied, "The way does not belong to knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion, not knowing is stupidity. The way is beyond doubt, vast and boundless as space. How can it be talked about on the level of right and wrong?" And of course, as these stories often end, at these words, Zhao Zhou was suddenly awakened. Beyond right and wrong, boundless, vast. These are some of the words, I think, that give us a little inkling into what Dongshan is pushing us towards. Move and you are trapped. Try to get there. Have this strong idea in your mind. Practice really hard. I'll get there. That may work for getting a buff body, but it doesn't really work for awakening. Dongshan and Nanchuan here in this little story I just read they both tell us that at the heart of practice is not a getting, but a letting go. That the heart of practice does not lie in striving to fix ourselves in some way, but in our releasing ourselves, releasing the stories that we have, the narrative that we have, into simply what is. And that what is, that thusness, that all-encompassing wholeness of our life. Next couple of lines here, our next line. Turning away and touching are both wrong, for it is like a massive fire. This is one of my favorite lines in this poem, telling us rejection and attachment are both mistakes. Rejecting or turning away from our interdependence, from the intimacy we share with others and the world. When we turn away, it is to be blind. We have become blind to the fullness of our life. And, on the other hand, if we get lost in the great experience of the oneness of things, that too is of no help. We must return to the world. It is like fire. It is like a massive fire. Refuse it, turn away from it, and you'll freeze. Try to get a hold of it and hang on to it, and you'll get burned. In several Buddhist texts, thusness or Buddha nature or other words that we may use, they are described as a great ball of fire. And I thought, that's interesting. Fire is transformative. Fire itself is in constant constantly transformed, but mysteriously it remains the same. It is alive, in constant motion, giving heat and light, accepting everything that's put into it, and it is ungraspable. Very interesting, beautiful image. In the Hindu tradition, there's an image of the god Shiva. Perhaps you've seen this image. Shiva dancing in a vast circle of fire. And dancing the cosmic cycles of creation and destruction, as well as the daily rhythms of birth, change, and death. Dancing in the fire. In the East Asian Mahayana tradition, one of the great four wisdom kings is known as Aklara. Pardon me, Akala. Or in Japanese, Hudo-myo, the immovable one. Hudo-myo is often depicted sitting upright in the midst of flames, holding a sword of wisdom. And in Japan, Fudomyo is known as the protector of the Dharma, a remover of all obstacles for us to understand the Dharma, and destroyer of all that causes harm. I'm just going to grab the statue and show you for a second here. This is a wood carving showing Hudo-myo, not in flames, but if it was a picture, you would see flames all around. And you can see holding, I think, the sword here of wisdom, ready to cut any obstacles that you may have. Not exactly a cheerful looking fellow, but he's one of the kings, and so they tend to look pretty scowly. So, let's go on to just to a couple more lines here. Let me just get my Just to depict it in literary form is to stain it with defilement. It is bright just at midnight. It does not appear at dawn. I find this a rather delightful kind of Zen irony. Dongshan is writing a poem about thusness, and in the middle of it, he declares that this very writing is an act of defilement. And this reminds me of the story of Vimalakirti, the legendary hero of the sutra that also bears his name, the Vimalakirti Sutra. So according to the sutra, he was a wealthy lay person and disciple of Shakyamuni Buddha. And according to the sutra, Vimalakirti's wisdom and eloquence surpassed all the other disciples and bodhisattvas that were gathered around the Buddha. And one day, Manjushri, the very embodiment of wisdom, and other students of the Buddha, came to visit Vimalakirti when he was quite sick. And during the discussion, they were all asked to give their understanding of shunyata, or this understanding of emptiness. Or we could say perhaps their understanding of thusness. And Vimalakirti's response came at the end, after everyone else had spoken. And it is written in the text. His answer was a thundering silence. Just to put it in literary form is to stain it. And yet, we see with Dongshan's efforts here in this poem, it's necessary to say something. We have to try to say something about this. And yet we should remember that the words we use or that other people use are just fingers pointing at the moon. But Dongshan warns us not to dismiss these fingers that are pointing. And although the Zen tradition is famously claims to be a special transmission outside the scriptures, not depending on words and letters, these very words and letters are aids and guides leading us to what relieves all suffering. We may ask ourselves, how have words and letters helped us in our practice? I know for me, they are important. But I too have to remember, they're just fingers pointing. So in this same couplet that we looked at is also the Chinese philosophical understanding of brightness or light and darkness. Bright or light is understood as representing all of the relative world. In other words, the vast multiplicity of all things that comprise the world in which we live. And it's because in daylight, the myriad nature of this world is really clear to us. The countless kinds of ants, the myriad leaves on the tree, they're all kind of clear to us in the daylight. And the Chinese view of darkness is that darkness represents the absolute, the profound oneness or radical inclusivity of reality. Because on a moonless night, for example, distinctiveness vanishes, and there's just vast space. Next line. Although it is not fabricated, it is not without speech. It is like facing a jewel mirror, form and image behold each other. Although it is not fabricated, it is not without speech. It, of course, here refers to thusness or suchness, the absolute boundless nature of all things. And by its nature, it is unconstructed, unmade, unconditioned. From the very beginning, of course, of the Zen tradition, the many teachers and adepts have really cautioned against just study and just use the rational mind, that doesn't really work. We need to go beyond that. And yet here in this line, Dongshan tells us words and speech are not outside the absolute, not outside suchness. Remember that line we just looked at? Just to depict it in literary form is to stain it with defilement. But at this point in the poem, Dongshan is suggesting more. It's not without speech. Perhaps words do have a role to play. They're not somehow outside. The meaning of thusness, this meaning of the precious mirror, is not created by language and not understood by language. However, this precious mirror, this suchness, is not separate from language. It is like facing a jewel mirror, form and image behold each other. You are not it. In truth, it is you. Mirrors. Now we come to a central image of the poem. Mirrors are magical. In stories, both in the West here and in East Asia, they are said to have very special powers. In the Chinese tradition of feng shui, mirrors amplify good fortune if they're placed in the right position in the house. And in the children's stories that I think we all pretty well grew up with, in the West, mirrors can tell us the location of other people, who is most beautiful, and at times be doorways into other worlds. I kind of fell into a bit of a rabbit hole around mirrors and discovered that babies recognize themselves in a mirror at about 18 months. Did you know that? And a variety of animals, including, of course, the apes, but also elephants, dolphins, orcas, and magpies, can also be aware that the image they see is a reflection of themselves. I think humans in all cultures have been fascinated with mirrors because we can see what is always hidden from us. We can see a reflection of our own face. We can even see our own eyes that see. Dongshan points out our practice is like this. We come to see what is usually hidden to us. Through Zazen, the mindfulness practices in our daily life, we come to see what is usually blocked from our point of view. Form and image behold each other, he writes. And isn't that exactly what it feels like when we look into a mirror? Before us appears another person. Maybe put that person in quotes. And we behold that person, and that person beholds us. We lift a hand and touch our cheek to see that this is indeed our image, because we are in the presence of a mystery. The image appears as interested and as slightly astonished as we feel, looking into a mirror. And even now, when looking in the bathroom mirror, the image and I are both rather surprised at how much the other has aged. You are not it. In truth, it is you. This short sentence refers to the story of Dongshan's own awakening. And Dongshan, after years of training, left his teacher Yunyan and went traveling, as was very common practice by Chinese monks during those days. And just before departing to visit other teachers, Dongshan asked Yunyan this question: "If I am asked to describe your teaching, how should I respond?" After a few moments, Yunyan said, "Just this is it." And Dongshan was bewildered. And Yunyan then added, "You are now in charge of this great matter. You must be thoroughgoing." And Dongshan left his teacher, pondering Yunyan's final words of teaching to him. And near the start of his journey, Dongshan crossed a very slow-moving stream. And looking down, he saw his reflection. And at that moment, awakened to the meaning of his teacher's last words to him. And he then composed this poem. "Just don't seek from others, or you will be far estranged from self. I now go on alone. Everywhere I meet it. It is now me. I am not it. One must understand in this way to merge with suchness." Everyday life and boundless reality are not two. In our minds, we may understand this to some extent, kind of maybe we imagine like pieces that form an ecological system. But Dongshan and all the ancestors ask us to go further. "You are not it, in truth it is you," Dongshan wrote in this poem, the Jewel Mirror Samadhi. Awareness of this skin bag, as the Chinese say, awareness of Michael, with all his memories, views, and imaginings, is not it. Yet these two are permeated with boundless reality. Endless flowing reality, or ta-ta-ta in Sanskrit, or thusness and suchness as it's translated in English. This is what the jewel mirror symbolizes in the poem, the absolute nature, the boundlessness of everything. I'm going to end this with a short quote from Suzuki Roshi, Shindu Suzuki Roshi, the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center. And hopefully he'll take us a little bit closer to this connection between mind and mirror. This is from his book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. "The mind which we will uncover or obtained by our pure practice is, as I said, something which is not graspable, which is beyond our words. But at the same time, this mind will respond to everything. So positively speaking, our mind is a mirror which reflects various objects in it. But when there is no object, the mirror is something which you cannot even see. This is the mind we will obtain, we will uncover by our pure practice." So next week, we'll continue the poem. I'll try to speed us up a little bit, or we'll be here for more than four times to get through the poem. But we'll see how this poem illuminates the tension between self, this idea of self and objects, and this intimate interrelatedness of everything. And I think that will be really helpful for us. So I hope you'll come back next Wednesday. And tonight, I'd like us to get into small groups. I'll put you in groups in just a moment to consider two things. And let me give you that right now. So this evening, two strong images around practice came up: fire and mirrors. And I'm wondering, in your practice and in your life, how do these speak to you? Fire, whether it's the same as Dongshan means, or perhaps it means something else to you. Fire and mirrors, how do they speak to you? And the next one, the next question you may consider, and please just choose one: what role did or does reading or words have in your practice? In what ways do you think they help? In what ways do they hinder? Okay, so I'll put you into groups of three. Please begin just by introducing yourselves. Just say your names to each other. One person begin, you'll self-time. Each person will have 3 minutes. And please just speak from the heart. I think everyone here knows the drill, what to do here. And I hope I'll call you back. I'll try to give you a 1 minute warning too before we come back. Sorry, I need to try this again here.